This is Stateside from your NPR news leader, Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Temperatures are supposed to drop next week. What's that mean for eastern equine encephalitis?
The colder temperatures begin to kill off the mosquitoes, and there's a much lower likelihood of virus transmission.
We'll check in with our political commentators about Lansing.
Well, I think this is the most dysfunctional budget process I've ever witnessed.
Limestone formations can mean big sinkholes.
What's happening is normal rainfall is dissolving that limestone, like it does in many cave systems.
It's just that these are under the Great Lakes. We'll talk to the Michigan Department of Transportation about how to make roads last longer.
We're certainly not shy about stealing great ideas from other states.
And we've got summer-like days and fall-like nights. We asked Tammy Coxon, what's a fitting cocktail?
And so I went with an autumn daiquiri today.
All that and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, why does the Michigan Department of Transportation build roads with concrete in some places and asphalt in others? And how can we make our roads last longer?
We are looking at innovative materials. We are looking at different methods and processes. But really, at the end of the day, it comes down to investment.
That's coming up later in the hour. But first, Michigan is one of the states hit this year with an outbreak of eastern equine encephalitis, sometimes called Triple E for short. The mosquito-borne virus has killed several people in the state. Animals have also died, including two wolf pups at a zoo. The state government recently did aerial spraying of an insecticide over 14 counties to try to stop the spread of Triple E. Now that cold weather is headed our way, what happens next? Joining us to answer that question is Mark Fisher. He's an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Lester.
All right. Well, first, just tell us why Triple E is so dangerous to humans and some animals.
Well, eastern equine encephalitis virus is a mosquito-borne virus, and it's one of the more severe of all the mosquito-borne viruses. It can cause neurologic disease like encephalitis and meningitis, and the case fatality, that is the proportion of people who die who develop encephalitis, is estimated to be around 30%.
We're supposed to get a cold snap across the state of Michigan, and we're wondering if that will have an impact on the mosquito population and the spread of eastern equine encephalitis.
Yeah, we expect to see a drop in the number of cases reported as cold weather moves into states that are affected by eastern equine encephalitis virus. The colder temperatures begin to kill off the mosquitoes, and there's a much lower likelihood of virus transmission.
Well, that brings up two questions. Number one, can the virus survive the winter?
Yes, the virus in the form of different forms of the mosquito can survive the winter from one year to the next year, but does not imply what will happen in the following year.
And how do mosquitoes survive a winter?
So the mosquitoes will survive. It depends on the mosquito has different forms, from immature to mature adult mosquitoes, and depending on the mosquito type, it can overwinter in the eggs, or the mosquito can hibernate or pass the virus on from the adult mosquito to the eggs, the larvae and the pupae.
Now, you touched on it a little bit, but since we've had this outbreak, I mean, do we have any idea about what might happen next year?
No, not really. There are a number of factors that affect the spread of mosquito-borne viruses, including the animal hosts, in this case birds, and the mosquito populations, the weather, human behaviors, and awareness. So it's very difficult to predict the number of cases will look like from year to year. For example, the last time we had a peak in numbers of cases in 2005 and 2012, the following years were very typical years for the numbers of cases. So what's more important is that people understand how to protect themselves from diseases like eastern equine encephalitis. That's by using an EPA-registered insect repellent and covering up with long sleeves, long pants when they're outside and possibly exposed to mosquitoes.
We're always told that reducing mosquito habitat by not leaving standing water is always advised. How effective are things like that?
Well, so people can take a number of actions themselves to protect themselves from mosquitoes. Like we just said, they can use registered and approved insect repellents. They can cover up wearing long sleeves, long pants. As you mentioned, they can control the habitat of where mosquitoes breed by reducing the water, that's standing water, that's in and around their home, like in wading pools, flower pots, and gutters. In addition, people can support the mosquito control efforts that are made in their local communities.
This, of course, is not the only mosquito-borne disease that pops up in Michigan. For example, we've had problems with West Nile virus. Why are there certain mosquito-borne viruses that we can't seem to eradicate in our state or find some kind of preventive medical solution?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's a good point. There are other mosquito-borne viruses other than Eastern Equine Encephalitis virus, and the most important and common one in the United States, including in Michigan, is West Nile virus. And we've had these viruses in the United States for many years. And really, there is no vaccine or treatment for these viruses, and people need to take steps to protect themselves from the mosquitoes and the exposures in order to protect themselves from the viruses.
How does climate change factor into mosquito-borne viruses in places like Michigan? What can we expect in the future?
So the recent Eastern equine encephalitis outbreak or activity this year that you had in Michigan cannot be directly correlated to climate change because there are many factors that can influence the numbers of cases we have from year to year. And these things vary, including, as we mentioned, the bird and mosquito populations, the weather, and human behavior. Climate change overall will change some of these factors and so could result in changes in risk of these diseases, but it can affect that in various ways, and we can't use that to predict what's going to happen in the short term.
So birds, you mentioned, I'm wondering about other animals. Can you be infected with the virus and carry it for long enough to cause a problem next year?
No. So humans and other mammals, large mammals, are considered dead-end hosts. That means that they do not amplify the virus. The virus does not remain in our blood at high enough levels or long enough levels that we can infect other mosquitoes even in the current season. And we certainly will not have it present over months or into the next year.
And that's the same for birds as well?
So birds will amplify the virus. They're an amplifying host, so the virus grows up to large enough levels that they can infect mosquitoes. They typically would not remain, however, viremic into the following year, so they would there would need to be reinfections of bird populations in the following year for it to expand again.
All right. Mark Fisher is a medical epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thanks for telling us about Eastern equine encephalitis.
Thank you, Lester, for having me on your show, and thanks for your interest.
Every homeowner at least occasionally needs some tools, right? But they can be expensive and sometimes inaccessible for some people, especially in low-income communities. A movement is afoot to help with that. Tool libraries are popping up in cities across the country. Now, Detroit has one too. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick paid a visit.
East Warren is the main commercial street through several neighborhoods on Detroit's east side. Tucked in among the beauty supply stores, pizza joints, and more than a few abandoned storefronts is a solid red brick building. A garage door opens up onto the street. A sign out front reads, East Warren Tool Library.
So how we like to introduce the tool library, it's we're like a book library, but for tools.
Joshua Arnson is the tool library's manager.
We have anywhere from push mowers to weed whips, wheelbarrows, we have shovels, we have screwdrivers, wrenches, power tools.
Arnson had visited tool libraries in other cities and saw the need for one in Detroit. He started looking for possible locations.
A lot of folks, you know, especially here on the east side, tools can cost a lot of money because a lot of people, they want to do things. They want to, you know, remove blight, maintain their homes, maintain the properties around them. So we're just able to give them the resources so they can do that.
People can check out tools after they sign up for an annual membership. The membership fee is set on a sliding scale based on income. Members can check out tools for up to a week. There are late fees, but the idea is to be open and accessible to the surrounding community. Kimberly Canty lives in Morningside, one of those surrounding neighborhoods. She's one of more than 60 people who's already signed up for a membership with the Tool Library, which just opened up in July. And Canty's already making good use of it. She says she's used library tools for several projects so far.
It's one, I helped my neighbor, and I'm working on my fence. I did some work in my basement with the tools, and my yard, and my neighbor's yard. I was able to use the pole digger to help fix my fence because my dog is a Houdini who keeps escaping.
Canty calls this place a blessing from the Lord.
Because everyone is able to use it, it's needed and wanted, and it was just a great idea. It was brilliant, genius. I should have thought of it.
The inside of the garage is as neat and well-stocked as any small home improvement store. In the back, there's an open space where they hold free classes. Right now, there are 8 people participating in a home building class. George Highgate is the instructor. Today, he's divided them into teams of 4. They're going to disassemble and reassemble a wall, from studs to drywall, electrical, the whole thing. Highgate says he's taught lots of home improvement classes, but never in a place like this.
Without going to Home Depot, the big box stores, and borrow their tools, because you need credit cards for those ones. Here, you get a membership. And so your word is your bond. And how many times you can say that now?
Highgate calls over one of his students, Greta Williams. Williams has been helping her husband rehab Detroit homes for years, but says it's always been in kind of a helper role.
And it's okay to be the helper. There's nothing wrong with that. I've learned a lot. So I wanted to know how much did I know and to build up on that skill set that I've already have built on with my husband.
The East Warren Tool Library already has plans to offer other courses, like upholstering. It's drawn a lot of attention and interest from throughout the city. There's already talk about replicating it in other Detroit neighborhoods. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
Coming up, what scientists are learning from studying sinkholes in the depths of Lake Huron.
When you have a zero oxygen environment and you have this sulfur and salty environment, it's somewhat representative of what the early Earth looked like.
Plus, we mix up an autumnal version of a tropical summer drink. That's next on Stateside. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Researchers are studying some oddities in the Great Lakes. Over the past several years, they've been examining sinkholes and the unique life that grows there. Steve Ruberg leads a study on Lake Huron sinkholes. He's with the Marine Instrument Laboratory at the Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory, which is part of NOAA. So how do these sinkholes form?
Well, we're sitting in Lake in Michigan on top of a karst geology, which means we're sitting on top of limestone geology. And what's happening is normal rainfall is dissolving that limestone, like it does in many cave systems, Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, those types of systems, just the limestone features get dissolved. Streams of water start to flow through there, forming caves, eventually forming caverns. And when caverns get all the way to the surface, they actually collapse and form sinkholes.
I read in a Detroit News story by Beth LeBlanc that groundwater flows into the lakes through these sinkholes. How much water goes into the lakes that way?
Well, it's not a large amount. I mean, the predominant amount of water goes into the Great Lakes through either rainfall or streams. And these systems represent really a small input into the Great Lakes as a whole.
The groundwater that flows undergoes some changes as it goes through the limestone. It becomes not water as we know it generally. What happens to it?
Yeah. So what's happening is, I mean, you know, we're like I said, we're sitting on top of this limestone geology that was actually laid down 400 million years ago, and there was a shallow seabed here. And as that seawater evaporates, salt is deposited, sulfur is deposited, and so now here we are with the system that we're sitting on top of. When rainwater turns into groundwater as it sinks below the surface, it dissolves that sulfur and salt. It loses its oxygen because it travels long distances under the through these rock layers. And when it comes out, there's no oxygen, and there's a considerable amount of salt and sulfur in these systems.
So what does that cause? What does that lead to?
Well, what happens is, I mean, since you don't have oxygen, then there's another sort of microbial world that we don't often think of, and they're chemosynthetic organisms that use that sulfur to actually carry on their life cycles.
Now, we've seen odd life pop up in like a volcano vents under the ocean and things like that. Is this weird or strange or different than that?
Well, these are considered, the creatures that are in these systems are considered extremophile bacteria, and so they do fit into that same kind of category. We don't often think of the Great Lakes as having those things, but we do have that.
So I understand they kind of form into large mats. Can you describe what they look like?
Well, they range in color and in extent. For instance, the ones that are near shore are cyanobacterial mats. So these are bacteria that actually photosynthesize. And so they can range from almost a reddish purple to a very dark purple in color. And then as you go further offshore and you don't have light impacting the system, you'll have these patchy white areas, which you often see in the bottom of the ocean in the somewhat similar anoxic environments.
I understand they swell up, though, because of chemical reactions underneath them.
What's happening with the nearshore ones is that they're creating almost a mat where gases can't escape that mat, and so they form these fingers as sort of normal gas is dissolving out of the sediments beneath them.
So these sinkholes, some of them are pretty deep, kind of otherworldly. What'd you think when you first saw one? I'm assuming you saw one on a screen of some kind, right?
Yeah, I mean, so we're the technology that we're using to explore these systems is what is called a remotely operated vehicle, and yes, you're diving down into at least the deeper ones into a pitch black area, and you're using only your lights. What you come upon is this cloudy layer that's along the bottom because of the difference between the groundwater and the surrounding lake water, and then you enter into that cloudy zone and you get to the bottom and you begin to see these unusual looking features on the bottom that are these chemosynthetic microbial mat.
So why is this fascinating to scientists?
Well, the really remarkable thing in a lot of these systems is, at least the nearshore ones, is when you have a zero oxygen environment and you have this sulfur and salty environment, it's somewhat representative of what the early Earth looked like. And so some of our university partners have been looking at the possibility of thinking of these systems as representative of what the early Earth might have been like.
Is there any practical things that might be done with this new life that we found?
Well, I mean, I think just understanding how life formed on the Earth is a very practical component of it. The groundwater itself is of interest to us as an input into that water model. That's what we do here, is try to understand lake levels. And as many people know, they're going up right now. But during low lake levels, that groundwater input, understanding how much is actually going into the system, can be very important.
Long term, what do researchers really want to study further about these sinkholes?
Well, I mean, we want to continue to really understand that biology that's happening in there. I mean, another component of what we do is really understanding the ecology of these systems. But longer term, too, from the groundwater standpoint, we want to be able to measure the amount of water that's coming into these into the lake through these systems.
Yeah, could it have any impact on we're seeing really high levels right now. Is this contributing to that?
Well, it does contribute, but again, it's not a large amount. It may make a bigger difference at times when we have low lake levels. We just came out of a period of time when we had low lake levels. Now we have high lake levels. But during low lake levels for commercial freighter traffic in the Great Lakes, just 1 inch of cargo loading can make a difference in how much money they're going to make off of their vessels.
And I understand you may have just scratched the surface on the number of sinkholes you've discovered so far.
Yes, I mean, this really started many years ago. There was a survey done at the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary on Lake Huron, and we saw some areas that looked like that we might want to go back for further study that were in a very deep part of the lake. And as we started to look at them, we saw that, yes, groundwater was coming out of them. But now we're wanting to look and see if there are many more of these systems that are throughout Lake Huron and potentially northern Lake Michigan as well.
Look, going to the bottom of Lake Huron a little better than going to the bottom of the ocean to find the kind of extreme life like this.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what you have when you have a system that's fairly unexplored. I mean, we've fairly well documented that much of the ocean bottom is unexplored. Here we are on this planet, and we are rightfully looking at other exploration of planets within our solar system. But right here on Earth, we haven't really explored much of the oceans. And here we are right in the Great Lakes region. We don't really know that much about these bottom areas in the Great Lakes.
Steve Ruberg heads up the team studying Lake Huron sinkholes. He's a researcher with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
You look at older generations and you think to yourself, why didn't you do anything?
I mean, you have to act.
We need to be moving, and we need moving quickly.
Our children's future is at stake, and we have to make changes.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been bringing you a series called Climate Crew, which takes a look at the work of people who are doing something about environmental challenges, including climate change. A fellow teacher tipped us off about Kevin Randall, who teaches at Granville High School. He decided something needed to be done to make the school a little greener. Kevin Randall joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the high school. How many students? What kind of building is the school?
We're a pretty big community. We have a large high school. There's nearly 2,000 students in our school. Each graduating class has between 400 and 450 students usually. So there's a diverse population and a lot of activities for students to get involved in.
And I understand you've got a group of students working with you to help make Granville High School more environmentally friendly. So how are they working with you?
That's correct. We are called the GHS Green Team. I have to first thank my predecessor, Mr. Terry Blevins. He started our environmental club and our recycling program many years ago, and I've just been lucky enough to take the ball and run with it. Our students on the Green Team do many things. One of our main goals is to raise awareness with the students and the adults in our building about environmental issues and how to live more sustainably. And of course, we're also trying to reduce the footprint of our own building and help the students of our school reduce their personal footprints at home. So there's quite a few projects we try to get involved in.
Right. Granville High was recently named a Michigan Green School and designated an Evergreen School. What does that all mean?
Well, the state of Michigan runs that program for the Michigan Green Schools, and you can apply every March. And when you apply, you get a certain number of points based on the projects that you've done. And there are three levels of certification, I suppose. And for several years now, we've been lucky enough to get the third level, the highest level, by getting 20 points for accomplishing quite a few things in a school year.
So there are four different categories like reduce, reuse, recycle, energy, environmental protection, and so forth. We don't have time to go through all 20 points, so tell me, give any idea some of the major projects you're doing at Granville.
Recently, one of our biggest projects was to try to reduce the waste in our cafeteria. So we went to our cafeteria supervisor, and he told us that there were 54,000 plastic forks that get thrown away in a year at Granville High School. So we applied for a grant. We purchased durable metal forks. We built recycling tables and recycling stations. And now every student uses a durable metal fork or a spoon instead of disposables. And that's just one way we're trying to capture the low-hanging fruit, if you will, by reducing our waste in the high school.
Give us another couple of examples.
Sure, absolutely. Recently, we built a garden at our school. Our garden is for flowers and for vegetables. Sometimes we're able to pick vegetables and give those to our teachers or to students who need them. We have a pretty strong recycling program here at our school. We recycle thousands of pounds of bottles and paper every year. We participate in things like school cleanups, and recently we just went out and did a cleanup on Lake Michigan at Holland State Park. So sometimes we're actually out in the community trying to do some service, and we invite the students of our school to tag along with us when we do those things.
As you mentioned, Granville's a pretty good-sized school, large staff. Why did you decide, hey, I'm going to do this? What motivated you?
Well, somebody has to do it, Lester. I mean, it's a really important topic, and it's important that our students have somebody that they can turn to in the building that understands the importance of this. And I also felt like I needed to do more in my life for my own two children at home. They need to know that their dad is working as hard as he can to reduce the effects of climate change and to spread the word and to make sure that other students out there are learning about this just the way they are at home.
I understand you also lead workshops in your area of the state on ways to combat climate change. So here's a little challenge. What are three things we can do right now to combat climate change?
That's a great question. The first thing that I think people don't realize is that they need to really make their home more efficient, make it more airtight. A lot of our energy is wasted by just simple inefficiencies that we can improve in our home with just a few dollars. Of course, we can reduce our food waste and we can eat a little bit more responsibly, a little more locally. We can eat less meat. A lot of people don't realize that combined with food waste and eating more locally, that's one of the top solutions to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, because so much food is wasted and so much of that turns into methane in our landfills. So that's a wonderful way. And of course, we can always do the small things like purchasing less and recycling more and carrying reusable water bottles instead of buying single serving disposable plastic things that need to be thrown away all the time. Those are just simple things that we can do in our daily lives.
Now, I can guarantee you that there are listeners out there shaking their heads, yes, and others are rolling their eyes. So what do you think is the best way to get people to do something, anything, to get involved in environmental issues or combating climate change the way you have?
Well, I look at it like the example that we would set for our children. It seems to me that when our children are small, we're always trying to teach them the right way to do things. And then when we grow up and become adults, we feel a lot of freedom to do whatever we want instead of what the responsible thing is. And if we ask our little children what the responsible thing is, they can tell us themselves. These things are easy to do. They only help the environment. They only provide a better example for our neighbors and our friends and our students and our children. There's really no reason not to do these things because they're so low effort. They cost very little to get started. It's just a personal choice to make.
Kevin Randall teaches biology at Granville High School, and he's been leading an effort to make that school more sustainable. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We know there have been others like Kevin Randall out there, but we just don't know about them, so we need your help. If you know of anyone who is working to make their part of Michigan a greener place, please let us know. To nominate someone, just send us an email with helpful information to stateside@michiganradio.org and put Climate Crew in the subject line. That's stateside@michiganradio.org.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham with another episode of Cheers to Michigan. Looks like another fall-like drink you have here.
We're in that transitional season. We're still getting hot days, but cool nights. And so I went with an autumn daiquiri today.
An autumn daiquiri. I always think of summertime when I think of daiquiris.
It's really interesting. The daiquiri is, of course, one of the most maligned cocktails out there. Most people have only ever had daiquiris made with frozen mixes, and they have a lot of artificial ingredients in them. And few people have had a sort of legit, real daiquiri. And the classic is just lime juice, white rum, and simple syrup, or even sugar in the olden days. But I think that that formula can be adapted to lots of different kinds of drinks that still play on the daiquiri structure, but take it in a different direction. And that's what we're doing here for fall.
So no slushy machine.
No slushy machine.
What do you have in this?
So in keeping with moving into fall season, instead of using a white rum, we're using an aged rum from Mammoth Distillery. And then it's got some lime juice, of course. Instead of simple syrup, I'm using a cinnamon-infused syrup, bringing those fall flavors. It's got some pineapple juice, just to round out the flavors, and some Angostura bitters, which are going to add some extra spice notes.
I like the sound of it. And aged rum, we haven't seen a lot of Michigan aged rums.
We have a few, but we don't grow sugarcane in Michigan. So since many of our distillers are focused on things that they can take from grain to bottle here, rum is definitely less common among the distillers in the state, but there are a few of them coming around. And like any other aged spirit, they take some time to come into the bottle. So we're seeing more and more of them, and some doing a really nice job.
All right. Well, I'm going to have a sip of your daiquiri now. Wow, that might be the best rum drink you've ever made for me.
That is high praise indeed, Lester. I know you don't like rum, so.
Well, I won't say I don't like rum, because you've made other cocktails, rum cocktails for me that I appreciated, but that one's delicious.
I really like it. I haven't made it with this rum before, and I really feel like the pineapple flavor comes through more than other times that I've made this particular drink, which I like.
Michigan pineapple?
Not yet, but you know, if we don't do something about climate change soon, maybe someday.
Okay. Well, cheers to the drink.
Cheers.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. My editor, Sarah Hewlett, and I were discussing why we use concrete for some roads, asphalt for others. Which one lasts longer? What's cheaper? What's more environmentally friendly? And how does the Michigan Department of Transportation weigh all of those factors and all the other factors that go into a decision of how the state builds or repairs roads? Well, joining us now is Brad Wieferich. He's the director of the Department of Transportation's Bureau of Development. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it starts with the basics. How do you decide whether to use concrete or asphalt when building a new highway?
It's a great question, and you actually just mentioned that there are a lot of factors that go into that decision. And quite honestly, to start with, MDOT uses a very robust asset management approach to how we get the most out of our pavements and extend their life. So when we build once a roadway is built and we're determining what the next fix is, our intention is to apply the cheapest fix that we can in order to continue to extend the life of the pavement. So we start out with preventive maintenance type things. You'll see us do crack seals. You'll see us do chip seals and some very thin overlays. And often we do those on roads that are still in good shape, but that's intentional. We want to take good roads and keep them good as long as we can. Once they're beyond that point, we can get into more of our rehabilitation fixes. That's where we'll take an existing asphalt roadway and do some, you know, pothole patching and then maybe cold mill or grind off the surface a little bit to get it smoother and then repave it on a concrete pavement.
Let's talk about those new roads just for a second, though, because, you know, not as much, but a lot of, county and city roads are originally asphalt. You do a lot of concrete, especially on the interstates. I mean, how do you decide whether to start with a concrete road or an asphalt road?
Right. So once we get to the point where a road is just, it's done, its life is gone and we need to reconstruct it, we have what we call our life cycle cost analysis, where we do a very strict analysis of the cost of that pavement type over a period of time. And we have to take into account things like the soil type that's out there and the traffic volumes and the amount of trucks that are out there and the future maintenance costs of different pavement types that we've accumulated databases over the years to be able to project that. So at the end of the day, we come up with what we call our equivalent uniform cost. So we can actually compare and see over time which one will be more cost effective. And that's actually required by law on any pavement projects where the reconstruction is over $1 million. but obviously we do that as a matter of course, just to ensure that we're getting the most value out on the road.
Well, you and I both know that there are a lot of coffee table folks out there saying, here's what you should do to make the roads last longer. Why aren't we seeing our roads last as longer as Ohio or Illinois or Iowa? Take your pick. What do you tell those folks when you're saying we're making them last as long as they can?
That's exactly the answer. You're right. We do often hear that, hey, you didn't build it right the last time you were out here. Well, because we use an asset management approach and we're trying to maximize investments, we're not going to go out and reconstruct everything. Ideally, that would be great. We could rip up every road and replace it full depth. That would be enormously expensive. So instead, we work with what we have. We work with the conditions that are out there in order to assess what is the most economical and prudent fix. So would it be great to go out and rebuild everything and do it what some people would say is right? Sure, but there just simply isn't the funding for that, and that wouldn't be practical, wouldn't be a real practical way for us to manage the asset.
Big road contractors, the manufacturers of concrete and asphalt, they all have, you know, more than a little political influence. How much pressure do you get from politicians to use one material over another?
Quite honestly, I personally don't get a lot of political pressure to use one material over the other. Most of our discussions is really about how innovative MDOT is as a department and how we're looking at new materials or additives to our materials in order to make what we have even better. So, like I said, we have our defined process for life cycle cost analysis that tells us which one we should be using. But on top of that, we do want to make sure that we're keeping up with the times. We're ensuring that we're working with our neighboring states. We're working with the Federal Highway Administration to make sure that if somebody's cracked the code out there on a better pavement, that we're using it as well. We're certainly not shy about stealing great ideas from other states.
I want to talk about the environmental impact of some of these materials. Portland cement used in concrete has to be kilned. That's usually in a coal-burning kiln. Creates greenhouse gases in the form of carbon dioxide. One study said that a ton of CO2 is produced for each ton of cement. Asphalt releases toxic materials in the manufacture and during the life of the product, including polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which can harm aquatic life, as among other things. Has anybody in the Michigan Department of Transportation looked at which is less environmentally harmful?
Honestly, I'm not aware that we have done that. The environmental discussions that we get into when we talk about pavement are mainly focused around recycling and how we're able to take, whether it's an old concrete roadway or an old asphalt roadway, and grind those materials up and actually reuse them. So whereas I don't think we've done a lot of research on the manufacturing process that you talk about, most of ours has been environmentally on the recycling piece of the materials themselves.
What do you use those recycled materials from concrete or asphalt for? How do you use them?
Oh, all kinds of things. The crushed concrete can end up being used as an aggregate that could be used as a base or additive to other materials that we use stone for. The asphalt itself, the millings, when we grind it up, it becomes kind of like a small stones. That can actually be injected right back into new asphalt as it's produced. A certain percentage is allowed to be recycled into the mix. So it's a great way of you know, sustaining and not having to fill up landfills with our materials that we can easily use and put right back into the roadways.
So we're seeing this big political struggle on how to pay to fix the roads, keep them maintained. I'm wondering if there's a solution out there that the politicians haven't realized, or what kind of questions you're getting from the politicians about how do we fund the roads?
You know, that's a great question. And like I said, a lot of the discussions that we have been having are about maximizing our current resources. Obviously, we want to make sure that we're good stewards of the taxpayer, and that's what we do. We are stretching our dollars. So we are looking at innovative materials. We are looking at different methods and processes. But really, at the end of the day, it comes down to investment. And we've been kind of on a decline with our conditions for quite a while right now. The analogy that I use a lot is your house. If you have a leak in the roof, you better go up there and patch it. You better do what you need to do to get that thing fixed now. Because if you don't, the longer you delay, the further this goes on, the more expensive the fix comes. So that's one of the things that we try very hard to make sure people understand. The longer we put off our investment now could lead to a much higher price tag later.
Brad Wieferich is the director of the Department of Transportation's Bureau of Development. Thanks for taking the time.
No, I appreciate it very much. Have a great day.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We are close to 2 weeks into the new fiscal year, and Michigan leaders are still looking at about $1 billion in line item vetoes and supplemental bills to get needed money to things ranging from county and city jails to charter schools to county-level health programs. Here to talk about that are our Friday political commentators. T.J. Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. Well, gentlemen, Republican legislative leaders and the Democratic governor are still talking and have plans to meet again. What's that tell you, TJ?
Well, I think that we're seeing a little progress. I mean, obviously, there were a lot of, I think, raw sort of feelings after the sort of the deadline went and the governor vetoed, you know, more than 130 times, you know, the budget with line items that were important to Republicans. And I think understandably so. I think Republicans, you know, Senator Shirky certainly had their nose out of joint a little bit in terms of the cuts that were made to programs that were important to them. But I do think that what the governor said was true, which was she wanted to come back to the table and to negotiate some of these things out together. And I think we're starting to see that happen. Again, these supplementals that Democrats are pushing here, you know, are designed to get people to the table. And I think that that's good for the process. What's going to happen in the long run, I think it remains to be seen.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that governor supplemental spending plan. Ken, I know every negotiation is different, but you've been in similar talks while Senate Majority Leader. What do negotiations like this look when you peek behind the curtains?
Well, I think this is the most dysfunctional budget process I've ever witnessed.
What do you really think?
Until they get it resolved, everybody loses in the short term. I think the governor and the legislature are and look dysfunctional on the one issue they need to resolve, which is the state budget that funds everything from schools to prisons to health care to college scholarships and everything in between. And more importantly, the people of Michigan lose. You know, kids can lose college scholarships. You know, we compromise public safety on county roads. Some small isolated school districts can't continue to operate until they get their funding. And so I think everybody loses in the short term until it's resolved. I do think long term, the legislature's power has been significantly diminished by her use of the ad board.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit. TJ, you mentioned that the governor put together a supplemental spending plan which restores funding to some programs. The Democrats are calling it a peace offering to try to kick off what I'll call budget talks part two. How's that going over the legislature, particularly the Republicans?
I think it's a bit hit and miss. I do think, as I said, Republicans really took umbrage with the governor's, 147 different line items on programs that were important to them. So I think they've been reticent to come back to the table. But I do think that, you know, the governor was in a position where she needed to, you know, exert some influence on this process. She needed to grab some control on it, and she was willing to use the tools at her disposal to do so. But, you know, when you look at this, and to Ken's point, this is kind of like the way this budget process has worked this year has kind of been like two planes that left from the same destination to go to the same destination, but they took completely different routes to get there. and each plane needed the other to land. And now they're in the process of sort of sorting out where did the passengers go and where does the luggage go and how did the cargo get from point A to point B. And I think it, you know, that I'm worried that again, that this is going to become the norm in terms of negotiating this budget. And it doesn't instill a lot of confidence in Lansing. It doesn't instill a lot of confidence in leadership here. And I think it hurts everyone. And at the end of the day, when we look at these things, the governor has to explain her vetoes, and Republicans can take some pretty good pot shots at her in terms of the things that she decided to veto in terms of, you know, how in rural areas, how people, you know, with autism, veterans were negatively impacted by this budget. So unfortunately, there's more work to do in terms of getting us back to a space where these programs that are priorities for everyone are funded.
Can this supplemental spending plan by the governor make any impression on the Republicans in the legislature?
Well, I don't know. But, I mean, there's a big lesson here. You should never try to box in the other side to the point where they look weak and effective, because then they're going to lash back in some way. And in divided government, these things, particularly budgets, if they're not win-win, they will invariably be lose-lose. And that's where we're at right now. It's lose-lose. I'm going to take TJ's analogy about the two planes taking off. You know, I think they collided in midair and crashed and burned.
Okay.
And they got to get this resolved because, like I said, if it's not win-win, it's invariably lose-lose.
Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and Speaker Lee Chatfield, as well as other Republican legislators, were not thrilled with Governor Whitmer's use of the State Administrative Board to move funding around in the budget. They say the legislature should hold the powers of the purse. Otherwise, this puts the whole idea of the separation of powers between the executive and legislative branches off kilter. TJ, what do you think of that point?
Well, I think that's just hard cheese. Governor Whitmer has tools at her disposal to be part of this process. And regardless of what GOP leaders believe in terms of them being the stewards of the state spending, all their bills, regardless if they're policy or budget related, need the governor's signature. And when you have this disparate process in which Republicans sort of stall and then they put their own budget on the table and jam her, you know, again, it's she won't react well to that. I don't think anyone would react well to that. And again, she has these tools at her disposal. The ad board was a tactic that has been, you know, weighed in on. It is legal for her to do. And it certainly doesn't engender good feelings in this process. But she has to be able to demonstrate that she has as much or more control of this process than legislative Republicans do.
Ken, does this move by the governor to use the administrative board throw off the balance of power between these two branches of government?
Oh, I absolutely think it does. I think that's why I say long term, the legislature's power has been significantly diminished by her extensive use of the ad board. And I go back to the lesson here. When you try to jam the other side, as Republicans did, the other side's going to lash out. And in terms of what she did, the institution of the legislature and their power has been diminished dramatically as a result. And they've got to figure out a way to rebalance this, in my opinion.
Well, hopefully we can talk about better news next week. Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow for public sector consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan Senate. TJ Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm, and a former communications director for former Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Lester.
Thanks, Lester.
Coming up next week on Stateside, we'll talk with an aspiring attorney who fought for years to make law school admission testing more accessible to people with visual impairments. This week, he finally won. We'll also check in with some Michigan companies about the impact of the trade war with China. And we'll find out what a Michigan farmer is doing with his first hemp harvest. We'll have all that and more for you next week on Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Mercedes Mejia, Adam Reyes, Tad Davis, and Catherine Newhan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.